Morning. How many of you can tell me what book of the Bible that's from? Ecclesiastes. How many can name that group? I guess it's time to preach. So, as David already said, the title of this morning is There's Something About Martha. Now, why would I decide to preach on Martha? Well, I'm not the pastor here. I'm Keith Rees, for those of you who don't know me. I attend this congregation. Pastor Dale follows the lectionary. And the lectionary has several texts this week, and one of them happens to be the story of Mary and Martha. And so I looked at this a couple weeks ago and started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, this looks so obvious, but this is a kind of a tough passage to preach. And I put a fair amount of research into this, and I thought, oh, this is going to be hard. And then I kind of worked a way around it. And I think Martha gets a bad rap. And so I'm going to try to redeem Martha today. And so that's why there's something about Martha. Martha, yeah, she kind of messed up in some ways, but there's something about her as well. The text should be in front of you right now. By the way, I think the most important person in the church is Zach, because nobody knows what to do if he's not back there. You know, people don't know what to sing. You know, people don't know what to say, and so I'm assuming that I'm going to say what he puts up there. So that's how we're going to work it today. The text is Luke chapter 10, verse 38. Let me just go ahead and read this text, and then we'll be working through it slowly. Now, as they went on their way, he entered a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he was saying. But Martha was distracted by her many tasks, so she came to him and said, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her then to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and distracted by many things. There is need of only one thing. Mary has chosen the better part, which will not be taken away from her." Now, if you've grown up in the church, you've heard this story preached in Sunday school. You know, Martha is really busy, and she doesn't get it. And Martha, you know, spends time with Jesus, and she does. And, you know, maybe there's a certain element of truth in that traditional understanding, but maybe there's more going on here. So we're just going to carefully walk through the text. Believe it or not, this looks pretty straightforward, but it's a very difficult text. There are a lot of textual variants. Now, some of you went over to this Dead Sea Scroll in the Bible and Beyond exhibit over at APU, and one of the things you understand is you didn't get a printed Bible like this all at once. People copied manuscripts, and they passed them on, and there are at least a half dozen textual variants in this passage. What that means is the English version that you're reading makes their best guess on what the text is saying and translate it that way. But it may not be the only way. There are other ways to translate it. So we're going to walk through this text. Now, as they went on their way, I'll come back to this in a little bit, because that passage, believe it or not, I think is one of the most important phrases in this passage, now as they went on their way. We'll come back to that. He entered a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Now, she welcomed him into her home. What Luke is really saying here is that Martha offered Jesus hospitality. One of the things we learned from the parable of the Good Samaritan last week is what happens when people don't have hospitality. And so one of the things we're going to see here is this has something to do with hospitality. How do you welcome Jesus? And so not did she simply welcome, it's implied that she would have provided a meal for him, would have served him. And so what Martha did here was the right thing. So she welcomed him into her home. She had a sister named Mary who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to what he was saying. What Luke is telling us here is she was listening to what Jesus was saying. Now, Luke's style of language is fairly formal. The Gospel of Mark uses a lot of these continuous verses. Jesus does this, and he goes here, and it's kind of like how you would tell a joke. A man walks into a church, you know, and says, you know, we use the present tense to describe past actions because it's more vivid. Mark does that all the time. Luke doesn't. Luke is more formal. But in this particular story, Luke is much more vivid in his language. And Mary was sitting at the feet of Jesus. She's intently listening to the words of Jesus here. But Martha was distracted by her many tasks. Again, there's a challenge here. This word task is what is typically translated as ministry. Now, but it's also the same word that's used for waiting on tables, which is what you do at a meal. So was Martha busy with serving Jesus a meal? Or was Martha busy with doing lots of other ministry? And it's not real clear. If you read the various commentators on this, you can see there's some division over this. And the word distracted here even implies that Martha really kind of wanted to get in on the story too. She kind of wanted to hear what Jesus was doing, but she was pulled away. She comes to him and says, "Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself?" Now, in English, we use emphasis and, you know, word, trying to figure out what I'm saying. The language, you know, like when somebody, your child does something, what were you doing? You know, it's the way we word something will convey whether you're expecting a positive or a negative answer. But it's very clear here from the text that Martha thinks that Jesus is on her side. She expects Jesus to say, "Oh, of course, Mary, help your sister out. You know, she's working hard here. Give her a hand." And so that's implied in Martha's statement. But the Lord answered, and this is the surprise of the story. "Martha, Martha, you are worried," same word that Jesus uses in the Sermon on the Mount to refer to people when they worry about their lives. And distracted. Distracted isn't really strong enough. The idea is you worked yourself up into a tizzy. Tizzy is not a Greek word, but you know that's you're completely frustrated. You've let this get way out of control here, Martha. There's need of one thing. Well, some of your versions might say there's need of a few. And again, what is Jesus saying here? There's some problems with the text. Is Jesus saying to Martha, "Hey, you've made me an 8-course meal. You know, a hamburger would have been fine." Is that what he's saying? Or is he saying, you know, there's just a few things you need to take care of? And again, it's a bit of a challenge on how to read this. In any case, in spite of some of the difficulties, it's very clear here that Jesus affirms what Mary has done here. She's chosen the better part. It won't be taken away from her. Now, what I want us to notice about this passage is Jesus doesn't get after Martha for doing the work. Martha needed to do the work. Jesus gets after Martha for getting after Mary. That's what's going on here. I found a couple of really nice quotes from, and I want to bring them out here. Fitzmyer, who's kind of one of the big guns in Lucan scholarship, says, "Martha's service is not repudiated by him, but he stresses that its elaborate thrust may be misplaced." That's what one person says. Another person, "A ministry that bypasses the word is one that will never have lasting character, whereas listening to Jesus' word is the lasting good that will not be taken away from the listener." And another, and this is, remember, this follows the Good Samaritan. "If the lawyer in the preceding story was criticized for trying to decide whom he did not have to treat as a neighbor, these words of Jesus correct those who try to make their service obligatory for everyone else. Both are forms of self-justification or self-concern." Now, Mary needed to provide Jesus hospitality, but the central concern about hospitality is paying attention to the guest. And maybe that's what Martha was lacking here. So, I want to know, just how has this passage been understood? There are two items here, how this passage has been understood. These are traditional ways that people have read this passage. One way is that the contemplative life is preferred to the life of activity. particularly some of our Catholic brethren in some of the monastery movement would see the contemplative life as to be preferred over a life of activity. So that's one way that this has often been emphasized. A second major way is, again, this is right behind the story of the Good Samaritan, and the lawyer asked Jesus in that story, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus says, "You must love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself." And so it's also been suggested that the story of the Good Samaritan shows what it means to love your neighbor as yourself, and that this story shows what it means to love God with all your heart. So Mary is put forward as the perfect example. But I think more is going on here. And I think we need to look more carefully at the context. There's the context. There's one phrase that I said we need to pay a lot of attention to, and that's now as they went on their way. As they went on their way. This is part of what is called Luke's travel narrative. There's a section of Luke's gospel from 951 through 1948 where Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem. And that's very important to pay attention to the movement of the narrative. Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem. Now, I'm going to give you about five verses we're going to read here, and it's very important to read these verses because we need to know why is Jesus going to Jerusalem. So the first verse is Luke 9:51. If I can find Luke here. Okay. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him. And on their way, they entered a village of Samaritans to make ready for him. This talks about how Jesus was not received well by Samaritans who didn't provide hospitality, which is something Mary had done. But when the days drew near, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. 951, Luke is 24 chapters long. Roughly a third of the way into this book, Luke tells you what's going to happen. Jesus is going to go to Jerusalem. He's going to die. You know, and so it's like a good movie. You know, you have some foreshadowing going on here. And then 13, 32, and 33. 13, 32, and 33. Jesus is warned here about Herod is after his life, and Herod is the ruler up in Galilee. And Jesus says, "Go and tell that fox for me." This is talking about Herod, king of Galilee here. "Listen, I am casting out demons and performing cures today and tomorrow, and on the third day I finish my work. You ain't touching me. Yet today, tomorrow, and the next day I must be on my way, because it is impossible for a prophet to be killed outside of Jerusalem." So a prophet is going to be killed. That would be Jesus. But it's not going to be outside of Jerusalem. 17:11. On the way to Jerusalem, Jesus was going through the region between Samaria and Galilee. 18:31. Then he took the 12 aside and said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be handed over to the Gentiles, he will be mocked and insulted and spat upon. After they have flogged him, they will kill him, and on the third day, he will rise again." Folks, we're going to Jerusalem. We're going to die. 19:28. After he said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. So throughout his narrative, Luke constantly reminds the reader here where Jesus is going. He's going to Jerusalem, and he's going to die. Now let's go back to the story of Mary and Martha. Now as they went on their way, where are they going? They're going to die. And Martha is really cooking up a storm or whatever she's doing here. And she gets bothered about Mary. And Luke says to Martha, "Martha, this is not what I need right now. I need what Mary is doing. I need somebody to listen to me." And so it's not that Martha's actions of preparation for Jesus are the problem. Martha just doesn't get it right now at this particular time. What Mary needs to do, she needs to do now at this particular time. So we're not making some universal statement that listening to Jesus is always the appropriate thing and working is always not the appropriate thing. Rather, we're saying that this particular time, this is what was necessary. And again, this text immediately follows the text of the Good Samaritan. And what the Good Samaritan did was absolutely appropriate. He provided hospitality. That's what Martha does, is she provides hospitality. So, where did Martha go wrong? Well, it's possible her work might have been overkill. Now, I'm not even sure on this. It's possible. But maybe she was, you know, going a little more than necessary. But where Martha went wrong, are you with me there, Zach? Okay. Is she put her agenda on her sister. Again, Jesus gets after Martha for getting after Mary. And it's so often for each one of us to feel that what we are doing is the most important thing in the world. And everybody else should be on our agenda. And in this particular case, Martha's agenda was not what Mary's agenda needed to be. Also, Martha violated the rules of hospitality. She tries to bring a guest into her dispute with her sister. You just don't do that in the first century. You know, if you've got a beef with your sister, you deal with that. You take her back in the kitchen. "Mary, give me a hand." But you don't tell your guest, "Lord, hey, tell this sister of mine to get to work." No, that was wrong. So she missed it there. But what is right about what Martha did? What is this something about Martha? Well, Martha was absolutely correct in serving Jesus and providing hospitality. On Wednesday night, we had a cookout thing here. And afterwards, most people had gone home. But David and Dan were out there picking up the stuff. And Fran and Sharon were back in the kitchen cleaning it up. And it's like, yeah, thank God that there are people who are jumping in and picking up the work. This is not the glory job. This is after everybody else has gone home. Somebody's got to clean up the mess. And so Martha should not be faulted for providing hospitality. And so we can't fault Martha, or we should not fault Martha for her work. And this leads me to the main thrust of what I'm going to talk about today, is work. Now, I've never preached a sermon on work. I've never heard a sermon preached on work. So this is new to me. So I'm having fun. I hope you will as well. There are two statements I want to make about work, and then we're going to expand on this. First, all legitimate work is a calling from God. All legitimate work is a calling from God. And secondly, work is any activity paid or unpaid by which an individual provides others with products or services which are of value to them. Now, this idea of work being a calling from God really is part of the whole Protestant. This goes back to Luther. And so this is not a new thing to me by any means, but it's part of this heritage that we have. So work is being a calling from God. Let me define here legitimate briefly and value. You know, you could be walking, well, I'm not going to define them. I'll just give some illustrations to make my point clear. You're walking along, a guy's laying on the ground, totally smashed, and he says, "Hey, give me some whiskey." You know, if you bought him a bottle of whiskey and gave it to him, he might see that as being valuable to him. But you may not really be providing value to him. That may actually be destructive. And so, so value has to be true value, not necessarily what somebody think would be valuable to them. Okay, so work. Work is part of the creation mandate. Genesis 2:15, the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. Other than reproducing, work is the only specific activity identified in the text of Genesis as the purpose of human beings prior to the fall. They are to make babies, and they are to till the garden. But now, these go together, because in the ancient economic system, the family was the economic unit. And so you needed to have lots of children to create wealth. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But the family is the foundational unit of the economic system. So it's part of our mandate. God tells us we have been created to work. Work also allows us to exercise the dominion that is commanded of us. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them, said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over every living thing that moves upon the earth." I grew up on a farm in South Dakota, and if you want to have dominion over the animals, you know, you try to herd cattle, you know, that's work. You know, might be enjoyable work, but it's work. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention earlier. Due to the fall, work sometimes is painful, and work is sometimes frustrating. But that does not neglect the overall value of work and the command. There are dozens of passages that affirm the value of work. I won't give all of those to you. And I know some of you might be looking for work, and I know that's very frustrating. And you have my sympathies if wanting to work and not being able to find it. That's a challenge. So back here, work allows us to exercise the dominion commanded of us. Earlier I mentioned the family unit as the basis of the economy. One of the problems they're having in Europe now is declining birth rates. And that's a problem we have in America with Social Security. Social Security was designed to have young people, it's a shell game, folks. There's no pile of money out there for Social Security. What young people make goes directly to old people. And when you have, you know, 10 old people and 500 young people, there's no problem. But all of a sudden, you know, people have fewer babies and folks get older. Well, it's not all of a sudden. It's a 50-year process. And so now you have a lot of old people and you have very few young people working. And there are very few people paying into the system. Something's got to change. It can't continue to exist because there's simply not enough young people creating. So, you know, I'm sure politicians are not going to propose people have more babies, but that would actually be one solution to fixing the problem. Work is a way to serve the Lord. Colossians 3:23. Whatever your task, put yourself into it as done for the Lord and not for your masters. This was written to slaves. Now, I know some of you might have been in jobs that you didn't particularly care for at times. I've done a lot of things in my life which I was not probably the most fond of. I grew up on a farm. We had to do everything. Cleaning out the barns, picking rocks. I had a job in college where I was picking up horse manure. You know, I would go after school every day, and this guy had very expensive horses. And I clean the stables. Well, you know, very expensive horses still have horse manure. You know, it's no nicer than very cheap and poor horses. But it's got to be cleaned up, you know. And my father has had many jobs in his life. And at one time, he was he's a very skilled welder. And he worked on some projects that were very good. Well, he had health issues. Sorry, I knew that this would happen. Okay. But I cried during beer commercials on TV, so. he was very skilled, but he had medical issues, and his hand would shake, and he couldn't weld. And so he told the guy, "I'll clean the bathrooms." Those bathrooms were the cleanest they'd ever had. Because my dad took pride in that. And you know what? There's no job that you can't put pride into it. You know, you might think, well, gee, this is just cleaning the bathrooms. Believe me, when they're not clean, everybody notices. You know? And so whatever task that you do, Paul says here, you know, you may have somebody, they're not grateful. You know, this is a master-slave relationship. He said, you're serving Jesus. So whatever that job is that you might have, even when it's not the best day, you're serving the Lord.
Okay, pass that now, I think.
Okay. Work. Work uses the talents God gives us. You know, we've talked about spiritual gifts in the past, and have you ever stopped to think that spiritual gifts have to do with work? Yeah, it's always doing something. It's always some sort of activity that provides services to others. Excuse me one moment. It's also how we serve our neighbors in our everyday activities. Keeping your yard mown, it makes your neighbor happy. Painting your house makes your neighbor happy. These are ways we serve our neighbor. Work carries out the cultural mandate, developing the potential of creation. David in Sunday school this morning alluded to that. We are co-creators with God. Now, God did a really good job. You know, you go to the Grand Canyon, or you go to Victoria Falls, or you look at a sunset. God did a great job with creation. But we're continuing to create. God made sand and oil. Sand and oil. Somebody else was able to take that sand and oil and make it into a smartphone. I was going to say iPhone, but I know some of the folks over here, Scott, you know, he's more of a Droid user, but so we won't get into that whole discussion here. But an amazing piece of technology provides wonderful abilities because some people refashioned sand and oil into something like this. So we continue to develop the potential of creation. Work obeys God's direct command. Exodus 29, chapter 20, verse 9, we're familiar with the Sabbath law. But on 6 days you shall work, and on the seventh you will rest. And 2 Thessalonians 3:10 talks about if you don't work, you don't eat. Now again, you know, do your best, and sometimes you have challenges. And work is also one of the core elements of discipleship and spiritual formation. Must one always work? Should we be a workaholic? Well, we have the story of Mary. You know, Jesus said to Martha, "Martha, chill out. Mary is doing the right thing here." And so, no. At times, we need to stop. We need to listen to Jesus. Cana of Galilee. Sometimes you got to have a party. You know, Jesus comes to Cana of Galilee, this wedding ceremony, John chapter 2. Does he say, "Oh, guys, please stop, let's pray"? No. Does he say, "Hey, why are you guys partying? Let's get to work"? No. He says, "Hey, we're short of wine." Well, actually, his mom says that. And so Jesus whips up another batch, you know, and he's ready to party. It's all a matter of balance. Balance. And the word, I know this word gets bad press, stewardship. Stewardship is simply management of our resources. Balance. I'm thinking of this praying thing. When I was teaching at a school up in Canada, we had a group of students that they would have these all-night prayer meetings. Sounds like a good thing, right? But then they would sleep in and they wouldn't come to class the next day. And then the evening they'd have another all-night prayer meeting. And then sleep in. It's like, guys, I think you're missing something here. Prayer is a good thing. But, you know, so is coming to class. Now, stewardship, I snuck this up on you. I know you think people are going to talk about stewardship. They're going to talk about tithing, right? No, I'm not. I'm going to teach you a Greek word. And the Greek word is oikonomia. Now, I try not to do that a whole lot. I tell my Greek students, a little bit of Greek is a dangerous thing. Don't abuse your congregation with Greek. But this is a good word, and I think we need to recapture what's going on here. Now, oikonomia literally just means house rules. It comes from, and etymology doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot, but people like to hear that stuff, so I told you anyhow. So it's literally the rules of the house. So Martha is the steward. Martha is the ruler of her house. And this is translated as stewardship in most English versions of the Bible. So the stewardship was the manner of the house. But at the same time, oikonomia is the term from which we get the modern word economics. Stewardship and economics are the same thing. But folks, we've had a problem. We've had a divorce. We've had a divorce between the church and the marketplace. We've had a divorce. The church has co-opted the word stewardship, and the marketplace has co-opted the word economics. So when the church talks about stewardship, they're talking about a tiny sliver of life. They're talking about your calling from God, or how you serve your neighbor, or generosity. You know, it's the tithing sermon. You know, we need to give more. We got a busted air conditioner, by the way. Did anybody hear that we have a broken air conditioner? Okay, just thought I'd throw that in there for you. You know, and so stewardship has largely been separated from the world. But the market, we have the word economics, and this is where we spend the vast majority of our lives. Now, I grew up, you know, we went to church 3 times a week. You go Sunday morning, you go Sunday evening, you go Wednesday night, sometimes on Friday night. We don't have a Sunday evening church, but we know we have a Wednesday evening service. But even if you come Sunday morning and go to Sunday school, you know, that's, what, 3 hours? 9 to 12. And you come to Wednesday night, you know, that's 5 hours. Well, you work, you know, 40 hours a week. And so it's a much bigger chunk of your life is spent working. And we tend to think of the market as serving ourselves. We get a job so we can make money. Well, folks, it's more than that. But we'll talk more about that in a moment. Accomplishment. The idea of, you know, career advancement, what we can accomplish. And it's money. So on the one hand, we've taken stewardship and used that to talk about how we give our money away. And we've taken economics and how we earn our money. And we've created this divorce between the church and the marketplace. We even see this in Foothills' mission statement. I didn't notice this until I was preparing the sermon. We want to make... Provide godly, competent leaders to serve in the church, right, and the marketplace. Oh, church and marketplace. We've separated those, you know, and I think that's a pretty decent statement. Then I realized, how can we pull these back together? Well, oikonomia really encapsulates all of this. It encapsulates all of life. And it sees work as a calling from God. Again, whatever that job is you do, if it's legitimate work, and I'm not going to quibble with you on what's legitimate and what isn't, that's a calling from God. And we support ourselves by serving others. That's the joy of the market. You know, if we do superior work, if we create a really great product for somebody else, they're going to reward us. You know, there's never an exchange in the marketplace of equals. I talk about economics. I love this stuff. It's not calculus and algebra and charts. It's everyday decision making. Every decision you make is an economic decision because it has a cost-benefit analysis. You know, seriously, you got up and came to church this morning because you figured it was probably better than sleeping in. You know, you're going to go get something to eat afterwards because you'd rather do that than be hungry. So, but there's never an exchange of equal value. You're always exchanging something with somebody else that they want more than what you have. And you want more than what they wanted. And so you give money for a meal because that meal is worth more to you at this particular time than that money. And they give you meal to you because this... your money is more important to them. And so we're serving each other's. Every transaction you make in the marketplace is a service to someone else because you're providing something to them. It's funny, I teach biblical studies, and a lot of biblical studies majors are going to be working in nonprofits, which is fine. But I always encourage them to do a minor in business. But stop and think, what happens if everybody works in a nonprofit? Somebody's got to make the money to pay for the people in the nonprofits. And so, again, all of this is from God. What is the take-home? Pastor Dale, our pastor, always has a take-home, so I've had to do a take-home. So the first, there's no test next week on this, but and there's no extra credit either. And yes, this will be on the test. What is the take home? The worker is worthy of his wages. Now, I'm going to risk being slightly controversial here. The worker is worthy of his wages. If we take the worker's wages illegally, it's called stealing. If we take the worker's wages through the power of government for illegitimate reasons, it's tyranny. Now, that's all I'm going to say. Okay? But think about how the government is spending your money. Now, secondly, people are not primarily consumers whose problems can be solved by giving them money. Rather, they are image-bearing producers of value whose main economic need is for opportunities to liberate their God-given talents and apply them in service through the work to which they are called. I like that quote. That's not original to me. I stole that. I have been blessed to be part of a think tank. I started some work a little over a year ago with the Kern Family Foundation. And the Kern Family Foundation, Mr. Kern was a guy who made generators, a company called Generac. And he made a ton of money. He was very successful, very good at it. And he put $250 million into a fund for various things. And one of their goals is to teach pastors about the market. Because so many through seminary students, and so they have a seminary program, and fact is most seminarians are clueless about economics, and so I've been able to be part of this this think tank and to figure out how it is we can train people in seminaries to have a better understanding so that they can be holistic, so we don't have them, you know, let's give your money, but clueless about the other half of that equation. And I've been blessed to be part of that. And lastly, a job or work. So many, this is particularly aimed at young people. You know, it's like, I need to get a job. Well, why? Well, I need to get some money. Why? So I can go watch movies or, you know, that sort of thing. But don't think about a job as a means to make money. Rather, think about what skills has God given to me that I can use that will bring value to somebody else. And maybe I can even be rewarded for that. And so there's value in volunteer work. We don't have to get paid for everything. There's value in volunteer work. You know, when people were cleaning up that kitchen Wednesday night, that's valuable. You know, nobody paid them that I'm aware of. Did you pay them to clean the kitchen? And so don't think about getting a job to make money. Rather, what is it? What skills has God given me? How has God endowed me so that I can bring value to somebody else's life? What can I do to help them? Okay? Thanks. God bless you, and have a great day.